most delightful of all the Oriental fables relating to Zen and Taoism is the wonderful series of crude but delightful old woodblock prints called the Ten Bulls. We do not know exactly where this symbolism originated. It was probably in China. But from China, it migrated to Korea and later to Japan. And among the Japanese people, the quaintness and simplicity, naivete of the little group of pictures, found a special favor. This series has been built into most of the texts on Zen that have been prepared in Japan in the last 300 or 400 years, and among those who have written delightful commentaries on it, we must list Dr. Suzuki, another prominent exponent of Japanese Zen mysticism. The whole concept is an effort to explain the relationship of being and body, or perhaps more generally, consciousness as the indwelling spirit of reality and the personality, which is the always clumsy, always inconsistent element in the human compound. It is said that a disciple once asked a Chinese sage, "What is Buddha?" And the old master replied, "It is a man seeking a bull or an ox while he is riding on it." And this, to a degree, is the basis of this peculiar but wonderful fable. The human being, according to Zen and Taoism, consists of a principle manifesting mostly as an instinct, and a personality manifesting mostly as an appetite. So there is a continual struggle in the human compound between principle and personality, between the instinct to achieve to some noble destiny and the appetite which holds us to the commonplace. The personality of man is likened, therefore, to this bull or ox. It is represented, to begin with, as in a wild and primitive state, living in a very pleasant valley, and used to the concept of perfect liberty. This ox, like a young horse that has never been ridden, has no concept of ever being bound to the service of anything. So the bull or ox in his native state represents the individual who gambols about the pasture as the wild animal does, free of all burden, free of all need, simply surviving for the pleasure of survival itself. In the human being, of course, the situation is somewhat refined, but not especially improved. The ox is that part of man which intends to do exactly as it pleases and always has. It is that part of man which, if it is angry, and has no reason to doubt its privilege to be angry. The ox is selfish because it is its nature to be selfish. It loathes responsibility because it has never been taught to assume any burden or duty. It carries no load, it serves no purpose, and it tills no field. This ox also represents whatever the individual at the moment is resolved to accomplish. His wants, his desires, his appetites, his ambitions, all these are part of the study of the black ox. And this creature has never even considered the possibility of being something other than it is. And here is where we get very close to the beginning of our Zen and Taoist study. That is the realization that any creature can become something that it is not. That is, it can manifest attributes or qualities the existence of which it is not aware. Surely the potential has to be there, for man cannot be that which he lacks the root or substance for. But he can have thoughts that he never expected to have. He can live in a way that is different from his common and general feeling about the proper way to live. So it is part of the Zen philosophy that it is conceivable that the human being can control his own personality. Now, at first, this doesn't sound like a very extraordinary achievement. Many people will say instantly that they can control themselves. A person told me not long ago that they had marvelous self-control. The only thing is, they never had any desire to use it. And that is about where the situation rests. We are all quite certain that we can do anything we want to do. But when the time comes, we never want to do anything very different from what we have done. And if the desire to do something better does come along, it lasts only a little while, goes to sleep again unfulfilled. But in Zen, there is this definite belief, this preachment, that man can take hold of his own life. He may have been born impatient and lived half his lifetime in an impatient mood, but it is possible for him to be patient. He may have lived in a highly competitive way, seeking only the satisfaction of his own desire. But it is possible for this person to be unselfish. He may never achieve this possibility in a present life, but it is still a possibility. For any individual can do that which he will to do. He can control his temper. He can refine his nature. He can overcome bad habits. He can break the bonds of alcoholism or narcotics if he wants to. If he has the deep and serious determination to be better than he is, and the willingness and the consistency to improve, there is nothing reasonable to man that he cannot accomplish. So our little scene opens in the story of the bull with a boy, the shepherd, or the keeper of the cattle, who is holding in his hand a very tempting morsel of green fodder and trying to attract the attention of the large black bull that is rushing by, going in the opposite direction from the boy. Boy is going one way and the bull is cheerfully going in the opposite way. And the boy is holding out his morsel of food to try to lure the bull over. This is the approach. This is the beginning of the struggle to bring the personality under the control of principles or of reality. And as the personality goes its headlong way across the pasture, the boy holds out the green herb. And on the side of the hill, back of the boy, is a pine tree growing. And in the sky above the bowl is a very deep, heavy cloud. There is a setting for this particular situation. And the setting is the beginning of the Buddhist Zen Taoist preachment. The herb that the boy is holding out as an inducement is the hope that through self-control the individual will escape misery. This is the temptation which is intended to lure the bull to the point where he can be bridled. The hope always is that man, following his own personal, selfish, self-centered way, is finally going to become so miserable, so burdened with the inevitable consequences of his own conduct, that he will receive the first inspiration of leadership from the boy in the form of an answer to some immediate problem. As the individual goes along, sickness strikes him. His home is disrupted. His business does not succeed well. His friends depart from him. And he discovers that this wild life of freedom that he has thought so much about and labored so desperately to preserve isn't paying off anything. He is free, but freedom has become his bondage. The very liberties which he believed he wanted have led only to the excesses in his own nature which have crippled him and injured him. So the doctrine, which is always the evergreen, the symbol of enlightenment, in Buddhism the Buddhist message is represented by the pine branch. This represents the promise of a more abundant life. It is the inducement also to bring conduct under the dominion of character, that health may be improved, that the daily problems that we face can be more easily overcome. And so the boy uses the only inducement that he can use. The bull is selfish, so the boy appeals to its appetite. And no matter how selfish we may be, we also want to be happy. And in our selfishness to be happy, we are brought gradually into the presence of learning. For we come to know in the end that only learning can make us happy. That only the improvement of our own minds and our own lives can solve the problems that make us unhappy. So the boy waves his luring bait before the animal. And when we turn to the second picture in this delightful series, we find that the animal has done the expected. He has gotten close enough to the boy for the boy to be able to put a halter on him. He has become more docile because he has gained confidence in the boy. He has gained confidence in the self. He found that when he came close and took the food that the boy offered, that no evil happened to him. The bull found that the food was tasty, that it was even more pleasant than that which was gained by going out and foraging for oneself. He also found that the boy was kind, that the doctrine which was symbolized by the young shepherd was a gentle doctrine, a wise and friendly belief. And so the bull did not object greatly when the halter was slipped over its head, for it found that the yoke was easy, and that the law, instead of being a terrible thing that was going to take away from it every liberty and freedom, was really bringing it into a relationship with insight. or a relationship with knowledge. The shepherd could make life better for the ox. The boy could make the life of the animal more secure. For human wisdom, or the wisdom of philosophy, can protect not only the inner part of man's nature, but also his outer nature as well, if man himself will permit. So a friendship is established between the ox and the boy, and the two together now head in the same direction. Through the beginnings of wisdom, a fraternity, a relationship, a kinship has been built between the consciousness in man and the body which must fulfill the works of consciousness. Buddha very directly in his own teachings explains that it is not the purpose of the doctrine to make the personality a troubled creature, or to take away from man any of the really good things which he can enjoy or hope to have. The purpose of consciousness is to enrich the person so that the things we have become really meaningful, that joy becomes real joy, that insight becomes real insight, and that understanding becomes a practical instrument for the achievement of everything that is reasonable and desirable. Once man has accepted the yoke of the doctrine, everything in his life is made simpler, made more convenient for him. He moderates his intensities and has less pain and sorrow. He controls his appetites and his body is healthier. He achieves moderation of goods and his worries are fewer. And so under the guidance of the boy, the ox begins his gradual transformation. And you will notice in the picture that when the boy has finally got the bridle on the ox, the nose, the very tip of the ox's nose, has turned white. Up to that time, it was all black. Of course, the black ox was the symbol of ignorance, of darkness, of benightedness. But after the yoke has been placed upon the animal, the place where the yoke is has turned white. This is the beginning of the transmutation of the ox. It is the beginning of the transformation of character. Also, as you look, you will observe that the landscape has changed. The dark clouds are gone. There are pleasant trees and mountains and a beautiful expanse of water. It is a very much more charming, verdant land than it was before. And the ox is slowly and ponderously turning in its course to follow the leadership of the boy. This is also the beginning of discipline. For in one hand now, the boy carries a rod. Now, we do not see the boy injure the animal with the rod, but the thought or concept of discipline is introduced. In this case, the discipline represents the leadership of consciousness over the body. It means that the boy now has the advantage. He is able to command the body, and maybe reluctantly, the body will obey. It has been a very delicate operation to get this far in this partnership. And working as we do all the time with folks, I may say that getting that halter on to the bull has taken many a sincere person 10 or 15 years of hard work. Always remember that that first effort is the most difficult. We resent so desperately the very solutions to our problems. And worshiping this sense of the right to do anything we please We forget to please to do anything. Still we maintain that we have this inalienable right to be miserable, to fulfill whatever purpose we intend. And any subtraction from this privilege is tyranny, even though the teacher may be wiser than we are. If the teacher interferes with our right to do as we please, he is a tyrant. So it is quite a strategic undertaking to finally reach the point where the personality, with its mind, emotions, and psychic integration, is willing to accept the leadership of the consciousness itself. But here the bull has finally done so, and the end of its nose is appropriately emerging from the dark cloud of its own matter or materialism. And the reason why the end of the nose is probably so pictured first is because the first release is on the level of the most physical of our appetites. It is on the level of our sensory perception, represented by the face of the animal. And having gone this far, we turn the page and we come to the third picture of the bull. And here we have a very docile, pleasant scene indeed. Here the bull is following the boy along the edge of a pleasant stream. And we cannot but remember the words of the psalmist, "He leadeth me beside the still waters." Well, that is exactly what is happening in the picture, precisely what is happening. The boy no longer has his rod either. He is now carrying a flowering branch, which again suggests, perhaps, the mysterious rod of Joseph with budded, or the mysterious shepherd's staff of Tannhäuser. At this stage in the development of the theme, the entire head of the ox is now white. This means its rational or upper part, the highest part of the personality, the mind, is now liberated, at least theoretically, from bondage. The ox, however, is still haltered and the boy is still holding the cord. Principle must still lead. The consciousness must still direct the way. Otherwise, the ox would stray and would not continue its journey. But the mind, now having been relieved of its darkness, represented by the head turning white, shows an immediate fondness for the boy. The ox and the boy are now truly comrades. And the ox is very happy in this newfound relationship. And in this relationship we find something of philosophy. For in philosophy the mind has accepted the leadership of consciousness. The mind has taken over a certain rulership even over the body itself. Like the great enlightened thinker, the sage, the seer. The mind has resolved to follow in the footsteps of the leader, of the boy, and finds its greatest joy now in an obedience which once it resented. With the mind more clearly developed, the purposes of life become more obvious. It is no longer necessary to tempt the ox with better fodder or fine foods. It is simple enough for the ox to understand the commands of the boy. Therefore, in this scene, the boy is speaking to the ox, and the ox understands him. There is now the relationship between consciousness and an instrument being developed within the personality itself, which understands consciousness and can respond naturally and properly to the commands that consciousness gives. So here is almost the relationship of master and disciple in the old Eastern way of learning. For in the old way, the disciple was the servant of a master. Surely this servitude was done only for one purpose, the good of the disciple. But in all the older systems, the disciple was taught absolute obedience. He had no right to question or doubt the will of his teacher. He had only the right to accept immediately any demand placed upon him. And the demands were usually such as would humble his pride or demand from him great patience or resignation, endurance and tranquility of spirit under pressure. These were the things that the philosophy of life dealt with. So now the ox, with its fine white head, follows quietly behind the boy. The rope is slack. The animal is following mostly of its own accord. It just needs a little leadership now and then. And consciousness itself turns back a little to encourage the ox to come along the way of life. Very simple, natural little pattern. The next scene, the transmutation of the ox has continued, and now the area of the heart is white. The animal is white in the entire forepart of the body. This means that not only has the mind been regenerated and elevated, but now the emotions have been purified. The desires have been transformed. And the most difficult problem that man ever has to face, the pressure of appetite, has been successfully met. We can often reason things out. And if the reason has a chance, we may win. But when some terrible passion racks the body, we are unable to control. That which is a vast emotional strain eclipses reason, drives us from our reasonable purposes, blinds us to the consequences of our own conduct, and under the pressure or stress of emotion, we are no longer thoughtful or rational creatures. But now the bull or the ox has reached the point where this part of its nature is also transmuted and regenerated. And now another very interesting thing is happening. The boy is now tying the ox to a tree. This tying the ox to the tree instead of to the boy becomes, therefore, the next step or part of this transformation or transmutation. The boy represents the spirit, the consciousness, the insight, the natural good in man, seeking to bring the body into a state of redeemed relationship with life. But the tree has a greater meaning. And all through the mystery of Buddhism, the tree plays a tremendously important part. It was under a tree in the garden of the palace of Kapilavastu that Buddha was born. It was under a tree at Bodh Gaya near Madras that the Buddha was illuminated. And it was under a group of trees on the Indian roadside that Buddha entered the Parinirvana. All through his life, the symbol of the tree went with him. And in ancient Buddhist art, particularly in India, the tree was always a symbol of the doctrine. The tree was the great protecting growth under which man could sit and be guarded from the heat of the sun or the wetness of the rain or the force of the wind. He could find security beneath the tree and perhaps also he could find there rest and peace, for the tree was the symbol of the oasis, and in the deserts of the Near East, the tree was the emblem of life itself. Wherefore, wherever there were trees, there had to be water, and where there was water, men could hope to live. So now what has happened? The boy, consciousness, has now tied the ox to the tree. In other words, has bound it to the operations of universal law. The tree is the symbol of the law. It is the symbol of the great doctrine. And this is a step which occurs frequently in the advancement of the purposes of discipleship in the Eastern system. Man himself, be he consciousness or be he body, depends upon the law. And in this relationship, the human purpose, the human desire, unfolds naturally until it reaches a certain stage or degree of growth. We begin by inwardly desiring to be better people. We begin by seeking to bring to an end the suffering of life. We seek that noble path which leads to the end of misery. And from within ourselves, like the good and kindly people of long ago, we build our little folk philosophies. We say, as the old housewife used to say in the small New England town, I just do the best I can, and I treat everybody fair and square, and that's my philosophy of life. It's a good philosophy. The only thing is, it has its limitations. We go a certain ways, and our own insight, our own instincts, are not strong enough to lead us further. So we must either come at the end to a little better, a plain or prairie or pasture, and there remain for a while, or else we must shift from our own initiative, from our own beliefs, our own hopes, and purposes, from our own interpretations of things. We must shift from these foundations and follow the ancient Buddhist Zen doctrine. I take my refuge in the law. Therefore, the three jewels of Buddhism represent the three symbols of the principles by means of which the individual in this system gained his hope of salvation. For the three jewels were the life of the Buddha, the doctrine of the Buddha, and the assembly of the saints. These were the basis of the formal instruction. And the individual passed from his own efforts to regenerate his own nature and came under the discipline of one of the great world systems, whether it was Buddhism or Platonism or Hinduism or Taoism. This is not so important. But somewhere along the way, the individual must take on the regular discipline, the ordered leadership of the great schools of wisdom. When he does this, he then takes the personality which is his instrument. He renounces his own leadership over the personality and binds the personality to the great pattern of existence. He therefore releases the bull from his own control and takes the opportunity to give the animal the strongest leadership, the strongest center, the strongest support possible, by binding it to the tree, by tying it to the immovable doctrine, the unchangeable basic law of existence. For it's this way the bull comes into the best instruction, the best leadership, the best help that it can possibly receive. Then also by releasing the bull or ox from his own leadership, man escapes a further negative possibility in his own nature. It is possible that man will renounce all the different things of life. He will renounce a fine home and become a wanderer, homeless upon the face of the earth, like the monks of old. He will renounce honors like the Taoist mystics of the Diamond Mountains and go off to hermitage in the hills, refusing to hold public office or have any part in the transactions of business or barter or exchange. He may give his wealth to the poor and his body to be burned. He may renounce everything that he possesses. And still, he has not renounced selfness. He has not renounced this mysterious something within the individual that makes him determined in some way to achieve his own purpose, regardless of anything. The Buddhist warns that even the determination to become enlightened can be a fixation of the mind, which will restrain and limit the disciple. The resolution to be good can quickly become an ambition, a gratification of the psychic determination. The resolution to help others can become the basis of a glamorous self-centeredness. Almost anything that the individual desires to do can lead to more desiring, and thus prevent the final achievement of the end that is most desired, liberation from desire. For unless man is able to achieve freedom from the instinct of desire, he can never completely release himself from the net and web of appetites and are from all the illusions and delusions that the mind can be afflicted by. So when we think that we have reached a high plateau of vision, we are really only under some form of paranoid pressure and we do not know the difference. So the boy ties the bull to the tree and gives up the leadership of the bull. The boy now has no longer the right to control or to dictate or to direct or to demand anything from the animal. The animal, or the personality, the symbol of the transitory mind and emotions, has now been turned over to the law to be established in it forever. The need of the bull is now that it shall obey the law and not the shepherd. It shall obey the infinite itself and no longer the personal consciousness of man, even though this consciousness may be essentially well-intentioned. So the boy finally sacrifices and gives up his friend, the bull, who is now an odd-looking animal with considerable areas of white. The forelegs are white, the shoulders and the chest are white. The transmutation is going on, but the boy is no longer the master of the bull. It has released it. It is no longer leading, demanding, or requiring. And we come to the next picture. And in the next picture, the boy is walking along holding the halter in his hand. Behind him is the bull. The bull is now white to the midriff and is really becoming quite an amazing looking animal. But now the bull follows the boy. There is no halter. Having given up the ox, the boy discovers that he cannot lose it. He discovers that once the personality, the integration of the mental, psychic, emotional complex has progressed to a certain point, It changes its own basic psychology and becomes the willing servant of the boy or of consciousness. Now it is the ox that is seeking. Now it is the ox that finds the companionship of the boy the most valuable of all things. Now the mind is turning naturally to the spirit and follows in the way of mystical insight and mystical illumination. We find this everywhere in the story of mysticism, both in Asia and in the Western world. We observe how the mystics, through their years of struggle, sought communion with the infinite, sought to mingle their own natures with this universal plan of things. And then sometimes, somewhere, the great wheel of the law turned, and to these mystics came some kind of an inner experience, an actual mystical awakening of life within themselves. And from that moment, the mind, the emotions, the person that we know became, in a sense, the dedicated servant of this experience which had occurred within. Among the Sufis and dervishes of Islam, this experience of God is called the knowledge of the beloved. And the moment the individual has this experience, he becomes the slave of the beloved. He becomes the slave of truth. He follows resolutely in its way, daring all things, patiently, inevitably, following with humbleness but continuity the subtle thread of doctrine that must lead through the mystic maze of things to the final presence of reality. So now the person has turned and pursues the man. The bull, having achieved this greater enlightenment of itself, having redeemed more and more of its own nature, having purified its own parts with increasing insight, begins to sense the need of consciousness. There comes a point in our own experience of life, each of us, where that which at one time we had to discipline ourselves to achieve suddenly becomes the most necessary of all things. As inner experience grows, as the divine takes precedence over the human in the mysterious structure of our being, man suddenly longs for reality. To him it suddenly becomes the all-purpose of things. Whereas before he was looking for the gratifications of the flesh, now he seeks the exaltations of the spirit. So quietly and patiently, and in a very friendly way, the ox now follows the boy without a halter. There is no need any longer of controlling the animal. The animal has found its own light and now chooses to be the companion of the spirit. And the garden and the foliage of the mountainside and the general view is most delightful. And even though the engraving is extremely crude, there is a look of extraordinary contentment on the face of the ox. The ox is well pleased with the whole thing. The personality now follows the way of the spirit toward truth. In the next picture, the ox truly has been made to lie down in green pastures. It is very comfortably curled up on the ground, and now almost all of its nature is white. There is just a small patch of black at the rear with the tail. Otherwise, the ox has now been entirely transmuted. And it listens with great delight, presumably, to the boy, who seated nearby is charming the bull by playing upon a flute. Here, the spirit truly is entertaining the ox. And the ox is very peaceful, subdued, and quiet. This begins to suggest the teachings of yoga. For in all these Eastern symbols, the flute, with its several openings, becomes a symbol of the mantram and the mudra, the magic vibratory tones and patterns, the secret steps of inner wisdom, the meditations and the contemplations, by means of which man gradually brings the total personality to peace. Here the individual, the person, the being within, has brought harmony and beauty and fineness and tranquility to the thoughts and to the passions and to the problems of life. We now have that beautiful pastoral concept of man at peace with all parts of himself and in complete conformity with nature. And for the first time in our picture, the peaks of great mountains rise in the distance. There is a new and universal vista opening. The peaceful soul, dwelling always in the music of reality, is here something like the Indian, East Indian concept of the bull, seated while the divine flutist, Krishna, plays the wonderful melodies of the spirit. The spirit, the self, is the great musician, the great harmonizer, the one that strikes the vibrant chords of life, is now entertaining the personality, the outer nature, which has been brought into complete and perfect harmony. The whole scene suggests meditation. It suggests that the individual has now reached a point in which he has achieved quietude. And in the quietude of his own inner life, he hears for the first time what Pythagoras called the music of the spheres. He begins to be aware of the celestial harmonies which cannot be heard because of the constant cry and the constant shout and confusion of mortal life. It is only when man is still, quiet, detached from all worldliness, that the wonders of the inner life can be made known to him. It is in this quietude that he hears the voice of the silence. It is in this quietude that the Spirit of God comes close to him, as this spirit walked in the garden in the cool of the evening in the old story of Genesis. So here is truly a happy, peaceful, contented scene. And to most people who could hope for such an end, this is paradise itself. All is peace, all is contentment, all is happiness and rest. The striving and the struggle ends, and the individual seemingly has reached his goal. But in the Eastern Zen philosophy, this is not the end. This is only a pleasant interlude. This is a promise of still greater things to come, more to be accomplished. But it is certainly the dividing point which brings in the second half of the series. In the sixth picture, it is the first of a second set of five which together make the entire pattern. Here we see the contemplative taking over, the inner life becoming victorious, and the individual turning more and more to the mysteries of the internal in the development of his discipleship and the patterns which lead to his emancipation. Now at this stage of the picture, we see in view 7 there is no longer any halter on the ox. The ox has had the halter removed. Also, all of its body is now white. The boy is now sitting on the far bank of a stream which flows between him and the ox. And the boy is sitting under a tree very quietly in meditation. And the ox is drinking deeply of the waters of everlastingness. Here we have the self which has found its ultimate peace and security. We find the contemplating consciousness detached from all the labors of things, and the great liberation which wisdom brings into the life of the person who is truly wise. The wise man is not one who is able to resist temptation. For beyond this is a greater virtue, the simple virtue of being untouched by temptation. Instead of being strong in the presence of problem, the individual is problemless. Instead of controlling his emotions, he finds that they no longer arise within him to be controlled. But when he has reached the point represented by this picture, and his nature has been fully inwardly transmuted, then there is no longer any need for the eternal watchfulness of consciousness over the conduct of the person. Consciousness is no longer a policeman. Morality, ethics, conscience are no longer the heartless dictators of conduct. The enlightened mind, the redeemed emotions, the purified body, these are now dwelling forever in peace together. There is no longer any problem, any rise of problem. Nothing can lure the consciousness away from the simple dignity of its own peacefulness. Though there may be confusion around it, it will never be confused again. It has formed its inward pact with reality. And the individual then has the strange freedom of being able to do anything that he wants to do, because he will never want to do anything that isn't good. This is a very high degree of your Zen mysticism, but it is represented in this picture. The boy is no longer even watching the ox. The ox is now completely subdued, and it drinks of the edge of a stream, which in this view divides it from the boy. And in the Buddhist philosophy, and also in most other religions, by the way, you have this stream of water. In the old Christian theology, it was the Jordan. And the old hymns about gathering on the other shore to welcome souls that have come finally to the bank of the river between this world and the next. The Egyptians had their celestial Nile that flowed through the Elysian fields, making them fertile. And in Buddhism, there is a strange ocean across which the ship of the doctrine carries souls to peace and truth. And at this stage in the development of our story, there is between the boy and the ox the mysterious river of life that divides form from spirit, divides one world from the other. And this mysterious divider was always shown in the old mystery religions and things of that nature as a kind of temptation, a test or a trial that the individual had to learn to bridge in some way through his own understanding. He must build a bridge to bind the worlds together. For the spirit belongs in one region and the body in another. But the ox now is drinking of the waters of foreverness. It has no longer bound itself to the material plane or the material garden in which it lived. It is seeking also the everlasting waters of the Spirit, that those who drink thereof shall never thirst again. So we find the purified ox now also beginning its acceptance of the great universal mystery of life nutrition. It is beginning to live not on the bread of this world, but upon the fruits of the Spirit. And little by little, its dependency upon nature, its dependency on the earth, its dependency on all mundane things is lessened. It has a source of food ye know not of. It has a source of constant wealth and strength and insight that flows out of everlastingness. So the ox in its own quiet way is attaining its discipleship. It is becoming the redeemed and purified and vitalized instrument for the manifestation of consciousness itself. It's a very pleasant, pastoral, happy scene. The mountains are not as veiled as they were before, and everything seems to suggest a wonderful enrichment and a wonderful purposefulness in all that happens. And so we come finally to the next scene. And in the next scene, something strange has happened. The earth has disappeared. The outer world has vanished utterly, and our ox, now I might say, looking a little embarrassed by it all, is wandering around on a beautiful feathery cloud, which is a very difficult place for an ox to be. It seems to be almost up to its knees in clouds, and it is becoming almost like the mysterious heavenly ox of the Chinese fable of the Bridge of Magpies, which is one of the old legends of the shepherd boy and his ox and the spinning maiden who wove the garments of the star gods. It's a very beautiful old Chinese fable. But now the ox is beginning to look the embarrassed part of a saint in its own right. The boy is still there, but he seems to be standing on some intangible ground also. There are no longer any mountains, there are no longer any rivers, but in the sky is a gobal that may represent the sun, and also four stars linked together with lines, the ancient Chinese way of representing a constellation. So the bull is now being picked up or gathered up like the Mithraic bull that was raised to become the constellation of Taurus. Now the symbol of the personality is moved out of worldliness entirely. And the individual, having achieved a very much higher state of meditation, is now advancing into